Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Tom Woods Show for yet another episode 2398 with our old friend David Stockman, former U.S. Congressman, director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan, had an illustrious private sector career, author of numerous books. I will probably at some point today make mention of The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Is it The Corruption of Capitalism in America or American Capitalism?
It's The Corruption of Capitalism in America.
I got it right the first time. Okay.
Either way, the emphasis is on corruption.
Right. Well, that book I love very much because it is, although a lot of us focused our attention on the material you had in there on the bailouts after 2008, That's an extremely indispensable part of the book, but that does the book an injustice because it really is a sweeping revisionist economic history of the 20th century. So I definitely want to say a couple things about that a little bit later, even though it's an older book. But before we get into the meat of things going on today, you were working in the White House a long time ago, back in the early 80s, and then you left sort of on principle because you thought they're not getting the spending under control and what can I do here? Did any White House after that ever seek your input on anything involving fiscal policy?
No, not
that
much.
Was it?
I mean, that was it. That's all she wrote, to use that old saying. Yeah, I became pretty much a dissenter. I became off the grid because when you add this up, it is really an insult to everything we thought we believed in. With the launch of Reaganomics in the early 1980s, we believed in sound money. I mean, if we got to a gold standard, great, but certainly we didn't want the activist Keynesian Fed that emerged in the years after that. Certainly, we felt that the deficit on a temporary basis might be tolerable, but it couldn't be a permanent structural policy in which the public debt relative to GDP goes up and up and up year after year. Well, it was 40% in the early 1980s, debt to GDP, public debt. Well, you know where it is today. It's 130%, and there's no stopping it in sight. So we've had 30, 40 years heading in the wrong direction based on fundamental fiscal and monetary policies that are dead wrong and not sustainable. And we're getting, I think, closer and closer to the edge, as we have yet another, you know, threat of a shutdown and another showdown, which I doubt whether it's going to lead to anything good, but it's symptomatic of how out of control this whole process is.
I want to ask you what might seem like a silly question, but I'm just curious. You were a pretty young guy when you started working in the White House in 1981, right? I mean, were you in your 30s?
Yeah, I was elected to Congress when I was 30. I served two terms. I was elected the third time, but then I became OMB director.
Let me stop you right there, though. I mean, what I want to know is, was there something surreal about being a youngster in his 30s, walking into the White House and directing budgetary matters? I mean, did you at any time say, how did this become my life?
Yes. Well, I think it was one of those happenstances of history that's worth noting. The reason I got involved in the Reagan administration was that I had been drafted during the campaign to be Reagan's sparring partner in the debate rehearsals.
I remember
that.
And
the reason that happened is that before I was elected to Congress, I had worked on Capitol Hill for Congressman John Anderson from Illinois. Anderson then ran as an independent. He was the first debate opponent that Reagan had in September 1980, and they drafted me to be his debate rehearsal sparring partner because Anderson was such a brilliant debater. They were afraid, Jim Baker and others were afraid, that Reagan would stumble before he even got to the main event with Jimmy Carter. In any event, to make a long story short, he did well in that debate. When it came time for the Carter debate, he decided that somehow I was his good luck charm, and he insisted that I be Jimmy Carter. Now, that was a real hard one, you know. I had to be Jimmy Carter for a week to get him prepared for that debate in Cleveland. He did very well in that debate. I think he won the election on the strength of that debate, especially that famous line, in which he said, and there you go again, Mr. President, when Carter went off on one of his tangents. Now, the reason I'm telling all this is that after the election, Ronald Reagan called me and one, to thank me for the work I'd done in the debate rehearsals, but second, that his kitchen cabinet people from California thought it would be great to have a young guy like myself, as he described it, in the cabinet, and would I be interested in being energy secretary, okay? Hmm. Well, anyone probably at the age of 34 would have said, yeah, I'll be energy secretary. But I had been working the fiscal issues pretty strongly with Phil Gramm, who later became the author of Gramm Rudman and Senator and so forth. And so I actually had the nerve to say to Reagan, well, that's interesting, but I would like to be OMB director. And he said, I'm not even sure what that job is, but I'll talk. Yeah, but he said, I'll talk to the fellas and get back to you. Well, here's the problem. The fellas in the kitchen cabinet were all Los Angeles, California types. They were good people, but they didn't have a clue as to how Washington worked, how the federal government is structured, and the fact that in the scheme of things, once the Budget Act of 1974 was passed, OMB had an enormous amount of clout. So he went back, talked to them a couple of days later, he called me back and he said, I talked to the fellas and we think it would be a great idea if you would become budget director. So I became budget director. That's how it happened. But it was a tremendous opportunity because I truly was a small government libertarian. I was a strong ally with Jack Kemp, Congressman Jack Kemp at the time. And it gave me a platform to really go after all the nooks and crannies and huge mistakes that had been built into the federal budget ever since the New Deal. We didn't succeed, obviously, in changing a lot of things, but it was kind of shocking at the time because we tried. It was the first time that anyone had asked for a top-to-bottom review of this monster federal budget and actually put on the table detailed plans for reform or agency elimination or program cuts like had never been done before. So that was kind of an interesting juncture. The point is, at that time, the public debt was 35% of GDP. The first issue that we had to struggle with was raising the debt ceiling. And here we've had endless debt ceiling fights. But at the time, it was the need to raise the debt ceiling above $1 trillion, if you can imagine that. And people were so concerned, almost petrified, by the notion that we're going to have a $1 trillion-plus public debt. It's almost we're going to turn to a pillar of salt or something if we did it. And unfortunately, we had to raise it. But here we are today, $33 trillion, not $1 trillion. I'm still around. Okay, so it wasn't ancient history. We're heading to $55 trillion. This baked into the cake, more than $2 trillion a year by the early 1930s, or 2030s, I'm sorry, $55 trillion. And I see no way of stopping by mid-century, which isn't all that far down the road, but well into the 2020s now, a $100 trillion public debt. Now, how our economy is supposed to function with a $100 trillion government debt load, which would probably cost $5 or $6 trillion a year, more than the current budget, or equal to the current budget, in interest alone, is almost unimaginable. That's kind of the realistic, unvarnished picture of where we might be heading. Not where we might be heading, of positively where we are heading, unless there's sweeping change of direction.
Well, I do want to get to exactly where we are, but I do have one more question from those early days. I remember from a conversation we had years ago, I discovered that you had been against the Vietnam War. And so today, your opposition to the military-industrial complex and the various foreign interventions is not something new. It's not something post-Cold War for you. So What I want to know is, during the early 80s, when Reagan wanted the military buildup to confront the Soviet Union, where did you stand on that?
Well, I didn't stand. I was run over and flattened, so to speak, by all the tanks that were coming from the Pentagon side of the Potomac. I did fight the buildup, and I did with a lot of good people at OMB. There's a whole division, National Security Division, where they really know the facts and the details. And we made the best effort we could to persuade Reagan that we didn't need all this spending and that we couldn't afford a buildup of this size. You know, the budget we inherited, the defense budget from Jimmy Carter, was $140 billion. Within a few weeks after the inauguration, Cap Weinberger, who was Secretary of Defense, came in with a plan to raise it to $350 billion at the end of a five-year horizon. So, you know, you can see what we were up against. And we didn't make much progress because Reagan really believed that if he had a big enough stick, he could conduct a better foreign policy. Now, there's a lot of mythology about the big stick and how that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rest. That's another whole debate. I don't think that's remotely true. I think the Soviet Union collapsed not because of our defense buildup, but because of communism. It doesn't work. They had centralized the economy. They had militarized the economy. There was no basis in terms of what we know to be sound economics for their industrial system to thrive. And it ended up collapsing, and the world was better off, and the Russian people are better off, obviously. But in the early 80s, there was a view that they were on the verge of first-rate capability, and unless we had a huge defense buildup, we were going to have a landing of Soviet forces on the New Jersey beaches and all that. Well, we failed in that. That started the modern military-industrial complex. It was in that era that the neocons took over the Republican Party and thinking, foreign policy thinking. And it's just gone from bad to worse. I've been writing recently about what I call the Eisenhower minimum. You use the military-industrial complex term. Obviously, that was famously warned about by Eisenhower in 1961 in his farewell address. But what people need to understand today is that if you take the budget that he said was more than adequate to contain the Soviet Union, which at that point was still at the peak of whatever industrial vigor it had, and it did have thousands of warheads aimed at the United States. It did have 50,000 tanks on the Central Front that still had fuel and parts, unlike later. But with all of that situation, with all those conditions, Eisenhower, who's the greatest general ever to serve in the White House, said the money at that time, the defense budget of about $50 billion, was more than adequate to protect the national security. Now, if you adjust that to current dollars, $2023, that's about $400 billion. In other words, the Eisenhower minimum in today's purchasing power was about $400 billion. Well, they're on the verge of passing a $900 billion defense budget for the current year. In other words, there's a half a trillion of excess in that budget that's all about being the global policeman, being the hegemon of the Far East, the Near East, the Middle East, Europe, the nonsense of this proxy war in Ukraine and all the rest. And that's one of the big reasons why we're in so much trouble fiscally, because if you're spending an extra half trillion a year on defense, and to get that through the Congress, you have to spread the money to all the domestic pork in order to line up the votes, you see what a terrible arrangement now exists fiscally. And that's why the Republican Party is totally incapable of doing anything about the budget. Half of the Republicans in the House are neocons and defense hawks and believers that this 900, well, it's 886 billion, but let's round it to 900 billion, is not enough. Half of them believe this isn't enough. And it's, you know, it's double what we really need. So when you have that in the rank and file of the Republican membership of the House, they can't be effective in terms of really coming to grips with this enormous fiscal monster we have on our hands.
Well, fast forwarding to today, I look on Twitter and I see people like Paul Krugman and others who want to promote Joe Biden saying, look, Biden has very bad poll numbers, but this doesn't make sense, economically at least, because we actually have a surprisingly robust economy with great numbers. For some reason, we're not able to convey this to the public, and Biden himself has got to be a better messenger explaining to people that things are actually really good. The thing is, the problem with that is, if things are really good, you don't have to explain that to people. They just know
yes,
it.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
So there's something fishy about this. But on what grounds could they plausibly claim that actually things are robust? What are they looking at? How are they pretending that it's really good? And what is the actual condition of the economy, according to David Stock?
Well, I think the actual condition is very precarious. The inflation that they think has come down dramatically is actually starting to rear its ugly head again. I think we got an interim low, a transitory low a couple months ago. It was never really at 8 or 9% in June of 2022. It didn't really get as low as 3.5% in June of 2023. It's just there's a lot of volatility short run because of energy or food or other volatile factors. But I think the underlying inflation rate is 5 to 6%. It has been for several years. That if you have 5 or 6% inflation for one generation, you cut the purchasing power of the dollar in half. Well, that simply isn't working. So the first point is they haven't tamed inflation at all. In fact, it's flaring up again. The second point is that if you look at the basic numbers of the economy, it's creeping along at 1% maybe or 1.3% when we really need growth of 3% a year or better just to keep this massive government budget above water. We've got a baby boom generation retiree. I'm part of that. In 2015, there were less than 60 million retirees. By the early 2040s, there's going to be 100 million retirees. Well, unless you have a growing economy at 3% at least, where are you going to get the revenue? Where are you going to get the fiscal means to support a retirement population and so-called welfare state at that level? So they can say the economy's good because the GDP number is not registering yet as negative, but that's pretty misleading. We got high inflation. We've got interest rates that have to continue to go up because the federal borrowing requirement is so huge. We've got growth that's barely creeping along. And we have an unemployment rate that looks low only because literally millions of people have left the labor force and are not counted by the BLS. If we actually look at the employment rate compared to the population, you know, we're at a pretty low level compared to anything in the last 4 or 5 decades. So they're simply peddling, they're spinning. They're peddling a myth when they say that we have a strong economy, and they're not warning people about what's around the corner. The Fed isn't going to be in a position to start the printing presses anytime soon or to bail out the carnage that's going to happen from these high interest rates. They're not high. I want to correct that term. They're trying to normalize interest rates, and as they normalize them, they've had to take the rate up from the absurd level of zero to about 5%. But there's nothing unusual about 5% when the inflation rate is 4%. In other words, the real rate is barely positive, and it needs to be much more than that if you're going to have a stable investment in the economy.
Hey, everybody, a quick message from our sponsor, CrowdHealth. If there's one thing we can all agree on in this deeply divided society of ours, it's that we are profoundly unhappy with our healthcare system and with our so-called insurance plans in particular. They were supposed to get more affordable, remember that? But instead, premiums have been increasing, deductibles have been going up, claims denials have been getting more common. Well, we have another option now, and that's CrowdHealth, which isn't health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. You can break free from the antiquated insurance system without breaking the bank and get into a healthcare option that fits your needs. As a matter of fact, look what I have here, a testimonial that I just got via email the other day from Anthony in New Jersey, who writes, I heard about CrowdHealth on your show a while back and signed up with your link. My wife and I are in our early 30s and are expecting our first child in October. To date, they have been great to work with, and I wanted to pass along a good review for them. I was curious to see how this would all work out during pregnancy, but they have been great. Highly recommend it. Well, you pay all this money for traditional health insurance, but do you get that kind of peace of mind? Well, CrowdHealth gives it to you. Your $50 a month membership includes the tools and services you need to get the highest quality care. So we're talking about telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, so much more, and no doctor's networks to get in the way. Plus, your own personal healthcare advocate will help you navigate the complexities of health events and even negotiate bills on your behalf. And you will, of course, join the crowd, a group of members just like you who help pay for each other's unexpected health events. Well, it's time you opt out of restrictive health insurance plans and let CrowdHealth help fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 per month. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get the healthcare you deserve. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. So how would you describe to the average person a few of the ways, leaving out the business cycle, a few of the ways that the Fed makes his life worse? Because you could say the Fed prints money, quote unquote, and prices go up, but then also eventually my wage and salary goes up, so doesn't it all come out in the wash at the end? I think that's as far as people go with it. What are they missing?
Well, I think they're missing the fact that those numbers that they use, that everybody gets a trophy. In other words, inflation goes up 2%, wages go up 2%, interest goes up 2%, profits go up 2%, investment goes up, everybody's made whole. But it doesn't work that way, because we're in a global economy and we have to compete against low-wage labor in China and elsewhere in the global supply chain. We have to compete against brand new factories that have been built in China, Mexico, and a lot of other places. And so therefore, if we have high inflation here, it doesn't mean that wages can keep up, and they haven't. Manufacturing wages have not even remotely kept up with inflation. In fact, any employment that's involved in tradable goods or services, including services that can be offshored to India, you know, like back office services or financial processing or helplines and so forth, those wages have not even remotely kept up with inflation over the last 20 or 30 years. So the key point I'm making is that inflation is exactly the wrong remedy at the present time. If we want an economy that's productive and robust and where living standards are growing, we actually need negative 2% inflation a year, not positive. I mean, I'm not talking about the flare-up we have right now, which is bad enough, 4 or 5%, but for years they've been trying to target 2%, and by that, I mean the Fed, and they have complained that they so-called undershot, you know, the inflation target from below. That was all wrong. Bernanke put in the 2% official inflation target in 2012, but they'd been pursuing that since the turn of the century, at least, and that was a giant cataclysmic mistake. We needed zero or negative inflation in order to get the high costs out of our economy and remain competitive in the world market. We didn't do that. So the bottom line is the Fed has literally savaged savers, because interest rates until recently were well below inflation. So that means people were losing principal. The Fed has really harmed wage workers in the competitive international market, goods or services. And basically, it's allowed a huge bubble. It's fueled a huge bubble on Main Street that's essentially helped the 1%, not with real investment gains, but simply with asset inflation that's been fueled by all of this cheap money and massive bond buying by the Fed. I'll give you one number that I think gives some measure of this. If you go back to 2003, I just start there because that's when things started to get out of hand. The net worth of the top 1% was about $3 trillion, and today it's $43 trillion. So there's been a $40 trillion gain. If you take the bottom 50% of households, the gain has been less than $2 trillion. Okay. So the Fed policies have created so much asset inflation that the top 1% has gained essentially 30 times more than the bottom 50%. Now, that the key point about this is that's not the free market at work. That's not capitalism in its natural mode. That is a hugely distorted financial system where the central banks have created a roaring asset inflation that's created windfalls for a very small segment of the population, even as savers and retirees and wage workers and farmers and small businessmen have been hammered in so many ways by the adverse effects of these policies.
Now, all right, so let me imagine, though, what somebody, let's say, from the Trump wing of the Republican Party might say. He might say that there's nothing wrong with that analysis, except you're overlooking, they would say, that a way we could solve this wage problem. You're saying that a lot of wages haven't kept up with inflation, of people who are involved in very intense competition with cheap labor around the world. Well, then why don't we just lock out that cheap labor? You know, isn't there some protectionist policy that solves that problem? What's wrong with that?
Okay, that's exactly what's wrong with Trumponomics, if you want to call it that. He has put enormous tariffs in place, particularly on China. Biden hasn't removed them, so you could look at it today at $75 to $100 billion of cost to the U.S. economy. Retirees feel the impact of those higher costs. Workers feel the impact. So yes, it may have protected a few jobs in the United States, but at the expense of an enormous increase in the cost of living for everybody else. That's the first point. The second point is that notwithstanding these high tariffs on China, our trade deficit is still far larger than it was in 2017, before Trump put all these things into a place in 2018 and 2019. So for the most part, what the Trump tariffs turned out to be were a backdoor form of foreign aid, if you could believe that. In other words, what happened was on the margin, low-cost production moved from China to Vietnam or to India or to Pakistan or to Indonesia or to Mexico, where the high tariffs weren't imposed, and the low-cost goods are still coming in. So it didn't create a lot of new jobs or regain jobs in America. It just created windfalls for the non-China countries. Now, you can say, well, then let's put a tariff on everybody. Well, you do that, and the next thing you know, we got retaliation from all over the world, from Europe and everywhere else. It just doesn't work. I mean, history is so clear that protectionism fails. I mean, the same argument was made to Herbert Hoover in 1931 when he signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. It was a disaster. So,
but David, people will say, but what they say is, look, it was behind tariff walls that the United States became the great industrial power. And now the tariff walls have come down. We have a very insecure middle class. We have jobs going all over the place. So they think that because these things happen at once, one caused the other. And that does sound plausible.
Well, if you go back to the late 18th century, 19th century, early 20th century, the tariffs were a tad higher than they then became after World War II, but not much. Okay, that's pretty much a mythology. But the second thing that these people never tell you is that even though we had modest industrial tariffs, and the reason for that was they called it a revenue tariff. We didn't have an income tax. We didn't have a corporate tax. We didn't have a payroll tax. So the federal government's revenue came off that sort of modest level of tariffs that existed. But here's the other big thing. There was no wall at the border. There was no passports. There was no limitation on the ability of domestic producers to attract labor at a reasonable rate in order to produce goods and to sell them both on the domestic market and on the world market. So during that same half century where you had, as they say, the industrial tariff, you go from 1870 to 1914, the population of the United States grew by about 70% as a result of a huge influx of immigrants who then manned the factories and the transportation system and the warehouses and the rest that produced the great economic success we had during that period. So the worst thing you could possibly do is have big industrial tariffs on goods and also have a wall at the border and not allow any new workers to come in, given the fact that the native-born workforce is actually shrinking right now. It would be a disaster. I just can't stress enough how wrong-headed the idea is that we can somehow close our borders to both labor and goods and live behind some high walls and expect to have a productive economy. We'll have an inflationary mess of untold dimension.
I want to ask you a question that goes to your book and your study of recent economic history. So let me have this little caveat for my fellow Austrian economists watching who are careful about methodology. I don't believe that we derive economic laws from experience in the same way that we don't derive the Pythagorean theorem by going out and measuring triangles. However, if I did go out and measure triangles and I found that every single hypotenuse of a right triangle was the sum of the squares of the opposite sides, I would start to wonder. You know, like there do seem to be certain regularity. Yeah. So what I want to know is, looking at the empirical data of the 20th century from the U.S., do suggestive patterns jump out at you in terms of lessons we might learn about how to create a robust economy or how to squash one after you've done this study, the Great Deformation?
Yeah, well, first of all, if we look at roughly what I call the golden era from 1950 to the mid-1970s before inflation really got out of hand, the average real growth rate was about 3.5 to 4% year in and year out. And that's even averaging in a couple mild recessions we had during that period. So I think the number to sort of scribble on the paper is 4% a year. Now, if we go from 2007 to the present, and that's when they really cranked up the printing presses, when Bernanke pulled out the stops and just printed money like there was no tomorrow. Obviously, we know the balance sheet of the Fed went from roughly a half trillion in the year 2000 to 9 trillion recently. If we look at that period, when they were really using every kind of stimulus imaginable, when the Fed was off the deep end in the money printing business, the average growth rate has been 1.5%. In other words, we've had a natural test, like you're saying, let's measure the triangles. We can measure the triangles here by looking at the pre-Keynesian economy, pre-Keynesian Fed and the post-Keynesian economy. And it's night and day difference. 4% growth per year on average versus 1.5. And we're barely hanging on to the 1.5. And some of that isn't sustainable because it's been fueled by growth of the public debt. So I think that's the answer. And I don't believe that we could even sustain 1.5% going forward, given how much debt is now dragging on the economy and the fact that interest rates are now beginning to normalize. Let's look at that just if we could, Tom, for 1 second. During this whole period, as the Fed has violated all the laws of sound money, as Congress has failed to balance the budget even remotely since the late 90s, the total debt in the U.S. economy, I'm talking public, the $33 trillion we have today at the federal level, you can add another $5 or $6 trillion at the state and other government levels. And then if you add in business debt and household debt, we have $95 trillion of debt on the U.S. economy today. $95 trillion. So if you have interest rates that were artificially low for almost 2 decades, and now we have to normalize to prevent inflation from really running out of control, you're probably going to raise interest rates at minimum by 500 basis points, 5%, compared to where they've been. Now, do the math. 5% against a rounded debt of $100 trillion is $5 trillion a year of extra cost that households, businesses, taxpayers, and the rest of the economy has to lug around. It's going to make a huge difference. And that's where we're headed.
All right. I want to just go back very quickly to that period you described from the 50s to the 70s, where we had the 4% growth and all that. One of the things they'll say is that was a period, though, of high marginal income tax rates. And that goes to show that high marginal income tax rates are not incompatible with robust growth. Now, sometimes the response from our side has been, well, not that many people paid those high rates and there were a lot of loopholes and stuff like that. But if you're going to have that be your argument, then you can't also turn around and say Ronald Reagan unleashed enormous economic growth by lowering those rates if you just got done telling me nobody really paid them anyway. So what's the real story there?
Well, I think the real story is that we didn't have nearly the competition in the global market in that period that we had after 1990, when the Chinese decided that power does not come from the barrel of a gun, as Mao said, but from the end of a British press. And in the short run, they basically unleashed their economy, drained the rice paddies of all that low cost but low productivity labor, put it in spanky new factories, and created an enormous competitive alternative to domestic production here. Now, under normal circumstances, under a condition of sound money, the high inflation that got unleashed in the mid-70s through much of the 1980s would have been reversed. In other words, we would have experienced deflationary pressures as a result of competition rising in China and the supply chain that grew up there. But we didn't do that because the Fed, by then, the Greenspan Fed, said we can't risk deflation. That's a terrible thing. And so therefore, we have to target positive inflation. It became 2%, and we'll print all the money that we need to print to get there. What that did was it stopped the disinflation that was utterly necessary to put us back into a competitive position with these new economies. In other words, unit labor costs from 1970 to 1995 soared. I mean, I've got all the numbers in different books that I've written and things that I've posted, but that huge increase in unit labor costs needed to be wrung out of the economy if we were going to be competitive. but it wasn't. So what I'm saying is that Reagan did cut rates, and that was helpful. But the Fed basically canceled most of the benefit from that as a result of fueling inflation for 25 years and basically preventing the disinflation that we actually needed to stay competitive. That's the real answer to that question.
What is the benefit, primary benefit, people get if they visit and join David Stockman's ContraCorner.com?
Well, the world is really a mess today. We've got wars we don't need. We've got a public debt that's spiraling out of control. We have central banks that are really ruining the basis for productive capitalism and free markets. And what we do in Contra Quarter is day by day, we address different aspects of those issues. And right now, we're in another shutdown mode on Capitol Hill, you know, a continuing resolution, the threat of a government shutdown, and so forth. And so I'll be commenting on that for the next couple of days, because as usual, the mainstream media will not be telling you the truth. Both parties are at fault here. It's not just the Democrats. It's not just Biden. The Republicans aren't coming up with very much that'll make a difference either. And they'll try to sweep it under the rug again. And I just point out what the real facts are.
Well, I've got the link here in the description, also at tomwoods.com/2398. It's David Stockman's ContraCorner.com, just the way it sounds. Check it out. Very, very much worth reading, David Stockman. I don't know how you write, you put out such quality material and so much of it. I'm in some ways envious of that. So good on you for that. And also thank you so much for your time today. I know you're in the process of changing locations and I appreciate you fitting me in.
No problem. And very good to talk to you, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, David, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.